Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Welcome, everybody, and thanks for coming to the RTC Weekly Download, where we review the old-time radio shows, some of them which got away from us because we were too young to hear them in the first place, or you just missed them because they're unusual. This time, we have a 1962 interview with Bing Crosby that was never aired, so that's maybe the source of some interesting new stuff about Bing, and we'll have an episode of Vic and Sade, Hank Gustafson Throws a Party. And we'll wrap it up a half hour from now with Wanted from 1950. This is Dope Fiend of the West, which is probably a pretty big title to carry out. So here we go with the RTC Weekly Download. Here's an interview from 1962 with Bing Crosby.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you're in for some deathless prose, as most deathless prose happens to come from a saloon. I am sitting with an old friend of mine named Bing Crosby in an atmosphere that used to be familiar to us when the world was young. We're in a bistro in the valley because they allowed us to tape here. And Bing, may I thank you and say that this all looks very good.
It does. The environment, I think, is very, very salubrious. You certainly ought to be able to come up with something interesting in these surroundings, don't you think?
Well, if we can't do it ourselves, I'm sure we can get help. You
we
know?
Can pick up a lot of volunteers.
Yeah, we can get old friends like old granddad, old Forrest.
Old friends.
some of the old friends to help us.
We don't have much to do with them anymore, though.
Oh, no. I don't know about you, Bing, but I sit in the windows afternoons now, and I try to look like Whistler's father.
I already do. I don't have to try.
You look very fit, Bing, and I was delighted to see you in such fine fettle today when you were working with Mary Martin.
Yeah, isn't she amazing?
What year did you first work with her, Bing?
About 1936 or 7, I think. She came to Hollywood then, and I did a radio show or two with her. And then she came over to
Paramount.
Was
that when Lawrence Schwab had her under contract?
No, before that. She was just a little girl out of Weatherford, Texas, where the finest watermelons in the world came from, and she lost no time in telling me that.
No kidding.
Yeah. And she'd been a dancing teacher in her little town teaching school kids, and she could sing and she could dance, and she was pretty, so she came to Hollywood. And I think we had her on the radio show, probably the first job she had, but she can tell you a little more about that than I can.
Well, I remember hiring her in 39. And we had her for a few weeks. This was after My Heart Belongs to Daddy, and she was breaking in something in New Haven. We only had her 5 shows in 13, and she went to... We went under, and the...
Well, she was quite a star then.
Oh, yes, she was on her way up.
She sang My Heart Belongs to Daddy.
Yes, this was right after that.
That's what made her, wasn't it?
That was the one that made her.
What show was that in? I forgot.
I don't know. It was something of Cole Porter's, but yeah. I had forgotten that she was out here with you, because I met her through Lawrence Schwab.
Yeah, she was with us off and on radio shows, and then I made 3 pictures with her.
What year did you do, or not what year, but what picture was it you did Way to the Sunshine's Nellie?
That was in a picture called Rhythm on the River. Jack Teagarden was in it, and Johnny Mercer, and I forget who else, Wingy Minone, I think. Oscar Levant might have been in that, too. I believe he was.
I'll tell you who I saw from our past the other day. Larry Binion, an old horn tutor.
Oh, yes. Knew him well, yeah.
Lawrence was very...
Where'd you see him? In town, yeah?
Yeah, I saw him in town. And
he's still pumping away on the sax?
No, he's in the automobile business.
Uh-huh.
And doing well, but he's a graduate of that original crowd that were all nested up in Whiteman's hair, weren't they?
That's right.
But I wanted to ask you, Bing, about the Sprouts, the Kinder.
You mean the new group?
The new group, yeah.
Oh, the new group is pretty active for an elderly parent like myself.
Didn't I see a picture of one Sprout in a pool getting an Oscar for something?
Well, she's quite famous because I think at a year and a half she could swim, and at 2 years or 2 years and some months she was doing 5 strokes and had passed the test at the Red Cross.
Who was teaching her?
Little girl named Virginia Newman over here in the valley.
I wonder if I could get her.
Can't you swim well?
Not good. Well,
don't go near the water. But we felt, in Hollywood and Palm Springs, wherever you go, there's swimming pools, and when you have little children, You just got to keep the screen doors locked, and you got to keep your eye on them all the time, or there might be a tragic happening. So we thought the best thing to do is teach them to swim. So now they both swim very good, and we're going to start on little Nathaniel any day now. He's just a year and 2 months, but he's about ready.
Well, I should say he should do something he can't lay down in the family.
Well, he's got to start, because we don't want to have to worry about him either.
Bing, if I remember correctly...
Every child should learn, I think, as soon as they can to swim and prevent an awful lot of these accidents.
Well, I can remember you in 1929 and 30 at a couple of garden parties.
I've swam, yes, sometimes fully clothed.
Look, my kind sir, this is Walter O'Keefe, and I'm visiting with Bing Crosby. We'll be right back. My guest is Bing Crosby, who goes back in my life a long way and who helped me in the old days and is helping me now. You know, Bing, when I think of the man in the flying trapeze, you were the guy who gave me that.
Yeah? You remember Little by Little?
Yeah.
Little by Little. That's another one of your songs.
Yes. You know, the trouble with my songs, Bing, the ordinary songwriter writes a song, and 6 months later he gets a statement showing how much money he made.
Yeah.
With me, it's different. 6 months later, I get a bill for printing, and it's very... Now, for instance...
Well, your songs are good. Maybe they're too good, Walter. Maybe you're writing above the public.
Well, Bing, this is a confusion. Now, you explain this to me. You are famous for making money on records.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Winchell's column came out one day and says, Walter O'Keefe's new song for Bing Crosby looks like a smash, and I thought it was. And nothing ever happened. I'm the only guy who didn't make money on one of your records.
Oh, I've been associated with many an egg. When the sun goes down, that one.
The one with the, well, Sinatra was publishing.
Yeah. I've been associated with many an egg, so don't feel that you're unique.
When did you ever have an egg?
Oh, cases of them. Grosses of them.
Well, the balance ran the other way.
Nobody can pick a song, what's going to be successful or what's not going to be successful. Anybody that thinks he can is kidding himself.
You know, Bing, I was wondering today as I sat there watching at the rehearsal, is Why Christmas the biggest record in the history of the record business?
Well, I don't know about that. It? It's the biggest for me.
Well, I know that, but isn't it...
Didn't Gene Austin have some... Big records like Blue Heaven and things like that.
Oh, yeah, but...
Of course, in those days, they didn't have the distribution, or they didn't have the phonographs or the machines or the jukeboxes like they have now, so maybe...
They didn't have the legend and tradition that's built into this one.
But this one is a traditional thing. Berlin has written a thing there that's become traditionally associated with Christmas, and I just kind of ride along on the bandwagon. Every year, people buy a few. Very lucky break for me that he wrote the song for the picture Holiday Inn.
This was Holiday Inn.
Yeah.
What do you hear about his new show in New York?
Mr. President, I haven't,
talked
about
it,
seen it? No. I don't keep, don't do much work anymore, Walter, records. We just make albums of old favorites, and single records don't sell much anymore. You gotta make albums.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rare single that comes through, I think the only one in recent memory, in recent weeks, has been Tony Bennett's record of San Francisco and possibly Nat Cole's record of Rambling Rose.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, these rock and roll things, they pop up and pop down. They don't last very long. But it's kind of a unique situation. Now we have two or three ballads doing well, which hasn't happened in 3 or 4 years in the popular music field, in the record field. We have A Fool Am I from Tony Newley's show, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, and now this... San Francisco thing, and Rambling Rose, which is kind of a hillbilly, but it's a ballad. Maybe tastes are changing. Maybe a popular favor is going to lean a little more towards some nice songs now, some ballads. Wouldn't that be great?
Gee, Bing, you know, I was talking to a guy recently, and he played over a song, and he says it sounds like the 1930s, and he was meant to be complimentary.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be a description of a certain type of stuff? Because I look back on the... On the 30s, and there were some gorgeous
songs
in those
days. Yeah.
And
some great writers. This song, San Francisco, sounds like a song that could have been written 20 years ago. It's just a nice ballad about a nice town, how the fellow wants to get home, back to his old environs.
You know, speaking of getting back to an environment or a home, I every now and then pick up my Gazette, and I see where Crosby is here, or the Dateline is there. And I've thought of all the places you've been around the world, Bing, and I've just wondered which places have intrigued you most.
The most appeal?
Yes, had the most appeal. Because
there's so many of them.
Hit the Orient? Mike?
Never been to the Orient. Farthest in that direction I've been is Honolulu. I just came from there.
All right, tell me your feeling on that.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's a wonderful place to spend a vacation. Great for little children. That's why we went this time, so the kids could get on the beach and learn how to handle themselves in the surf and the music of the islands.
Did you go surfboarding?
Not me. I'm a little old for that kind of a caper. Well, and they're a little young. They did get up on the board and ride in with the beach boys. You spend half their day on the beach with these beach boys. You give these big fellas a couple of bucks to look after the kids, and they love to do it. And the children love the beach boys. They're gentle and sympathetic types, you know. And they play the ukuleles, and they sing, and the flowers and the music, and the weather's benign, and it's a great place to spend a vacation. I like to go to Europe once a
year. Where did you stay in Honolulu?
Just a day or two in Honolulu. We went to the outer islands, a place called Kauai.
I know it.
That's called the Garden Island.
I suppose
it's probably the loveliest of all the islands. That's according to the literature they give out, and everybody seems to agree because of the flowers.
Look, Bing, stand by.
Yeah, sure.
My special guest here is Bing Crosby. We'll be back in just a little while with Walter O'Keefe. Was that the 8 minutes? Here we go. I have been sitting in a man named Bing Crosby, and he's been talking about the enjoyment he had in Honolulu recently, which I echo very much.
Mm-hmm.
Bing, one thing. Didn't you think, or don't you think, all Hawaiian music sounds the same?
Yes, but I like it very much. The basis for a lot of Hawaiian music goes back to old hymns from the missionaries who landed there decades ago,
mm-hmm.
and they converted some of these islanders, and that's how some of these melodies developed. Of course, the Hawaiians put the beat under them, the rhythm,
mm-hmm.
and the accompaniment, the ukulele and the traditional steel guitar, and the bongo drum sometimes. But a great deal of the Hawaiian music comes from old church music. These New England missionaries who went out there and settled. And some of it's very beautiful. And they're writing some good things over there now, some beautiful music, and there's some very good musicians, and of course we know some beautiful singers, some wonderful vocalists,
mm-hmm.
like Ray Kinney, and this Alfred Opaka, who came
have
to
have you done the wedding song with anybody?
Yes, I made a record.
Who'd you do
that
with?
I made it.
That's a beautiful thing, Bing.
Oh, some years ago for Decca, I believe it was. That's a very beautiful thing. We tried to do it with an American lyric that Johnny Burke wrote. It was a beautiful lyric too, but it kind of spoiled the song. Really, it has to be done in the native tongue. It seems to me to be effective.
Bing, there was a song I heard Jolson do one night when Ben Burney was Master of Ceremonies at the College Inn Chicago. Remember back in the
days? Yeah, College Inn.
And Jolson got up. It was a song, a Jewish song or Hebrew song.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about three guys discussing a cantor that used to be in the village. And one was a shoemaker and one was a truck driver. And I forget, but each one related the way the cantor could sing in terms of delivering an authentic performance
uh-huh.
to, say, making shoes or driving. Did you ever hear this?
No, I never heard him do that.
It's one of the most electrifying things, and it'd be a great thing for you.
What way you get a hold of it?
I don't know. I'll find out.
What's his old piano player's name?
Who's Jolson?
Harry X.
Harry. Good heavens. Dr. Harry X.
Yeah.
What was the doctorate there?
I don't remember the doctor, but Harry X traveled with him for years and played piano for him.
No, this is a song that...
he would know.
This is a song I like to hear you do, yeah. because this is a powerful song. Now, I wanted to know about the European things, Bing. Have you... you did a picture over there last year with Hope, didn't you?
Yeah, over in England. And then I did a picture in France several years before that called
That's
Little
right.
Boy Lost. But that's the only two times
I've worked. Nicole Murray?
Mm-hmm. And Claude Dauphin. And a little boy named Christian Fourcade. But those are the only two times I've done any films there. I've done a lot of broadcasts from there. Taped them. Made some records there. And did a few benefits, charity things in France and in England. But most of the time I go just for a trip.
Have you
myself.
Done a command performance transaction?
Never did that. I was asked once, but I had to get home or something. I forget what interfered. Hope's done two or three. But of course, he's always eager to go on. He'll fly 1,000 miles or 2,000 miles to do a show for four or five people in the telephone booth. Loves an audience, this boy.
Bing, what do you hear from the
little principality off the coast of... I was on my way to Lourdes a few years ago, and I had some time, and I saw that whole army in review one day.
At Monaco?
Grace Kelly's Monaco.
Well, we spent a day with Grace and her husband and the two children and our little children last September down in Monaco. They have a place up on the mountain in back of Monaco, a place called Rocagel. It's right straight up the hill, about 3,000 feet, and they got a little farm up there. We went over in the morning and had a little breakfast, and then we played some golf with Prince Rainier and the priest who is the parish priest of their church. And then we had a nice afternoon and dinner and went on home. And she has two of the most delightful children, attractive, well-behaved, speak French and English equally well. And they're almost the same age as our two oldest. I think they're maybe a few months older, each one of them, than my boy and my girl, but they got along famously, and we took some pictures and had a jolly good time. Grace was in fine form. I never saw her look more beautiful, more poised, more serene.
Well, is Monaco going to declare war on France?
I don't think so. There was we were there just about at the time that this thing was starting to gel. I think it's all quieted down now. I had a letter from her recently, and she seemed to feel it was going to be adjusted satisfactorily for everybody.
I wanted to show you my card. I don't know whether it got to you.
Wait till I get my Ben Franklin's on.
Yeah. I had to show. He was speaking of playing golf with a priest, and I...
Oh, that's very nice. I'm a very important Catholic. In case of accident, please call a bishop.
I thought you... Keep it. Yeah, I thought you might have some fun with that. When you mentioned the golf match and the bishop, I thought...
Jimmy McHugh ought to have one of these.
Yeah, I'll get one.
Yeah, he passes the plate only at high mass and with the striped trousers and the frock coat. Oh,
well,
Jim, great songwriter, great friend of mine.
I'll have to get to Jimmy and see if he gets a copy. Mm-hmm. Now, Bing, tell me about the rest of the television year. How many shows do you do this year?
Well, I've got this one, and then which is on Christmas Eve, and then I'm going to do a show with Dinah Shore, which will be on in March. Then I got the golf show, which will be on in January. And then probably another spectacular in the spring. We haven't even cast that yet, or don't know how... what it'll be composed of, or when it'll go on. And then I got this little company of mine that's producing Ben Casey, and we're doing two other products.
This little company?
Well, that's the only one we got, Ben Casey, and when you compare that to Review and Four Star, who have 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 shows, I think that we're just beginning, really.
No, but that...
We got two pilots that we are hopeful about.
Good, but the Casey thing, of course, is command.
It caught on, great.
I was awfully glad to see Buddy Ebsen hit with.
Isn't that wonderful? He's got this Beverly Hills Billy thing now.
That's very exciting.
Number one show, isn't it?
Yes, it's the number one show.
I'm glad for Buddy. He deserves it.
Oh, he waited it out.
Yeah.
He waited it out, and he's as happy as.
Doesn't even have to hoof, huh?
No, he doesn't even have to shave.
Ha! You
I mean,
love
he
that.
He's got to be as dapper as you.
Be a regular beach boy.
Well, Bing, of course, the public prints made much of the fact that you turned over your Hogan down in the desert to that social upstart from Washington.
Yes,
tell me about
JFK.
That.
Well, I had a call from a friend of mine, another Irishman named Dunphy. This was last spring, Christopher Dunphy, who was an intimate of the president.
This is last spring? They booked that far ahead?
No, he used it last spring.
Oh, I see.
Dunphy's sort of a camp follower.
Yeah.
An old golfing pal of mine, and he said, a friend of mine would like to use your house at Palm Springs. And I thought, well, you've got a lot of crust. A friend of yours, probably another golf hustler he's trying to put in my joint. He said, the president. Well, of course, I was impressed and agreeable, and he spent a couple of days there last spring and liked it. So he had another call from Mr. Dunphy this fall, and they said he wanted to use it again. It's an ideal place for the president, because I guess it's very easy to police. It backs right up to the mountains.
I know.
And all they have to do is put a couple guys out around the front, and he's safe from any intrusion or anything of that nature. So I'm tickled to death at the president.
When are you going to take over the White House for a weekend?
I wonder if you let me move in there.
Hey, why don't you
move
do
in
that?
The U.S. Grant room or something.
May I thank you very much for coming by, Bing?
Walter, it's so good to see you again and talk to you and chat with you. I wish we could go on for a couple hours. I think we could really cut up some touches here. I don't know how much of it would be censorable. Might not get it all on.
Oh, no.
It's on tape. We could edit it.
My special
Thanks,
guest
Walter.
Has been Big Crosby. I'll be back in a little while. This is Walter O'Keefe.
And now we proudly present your master of ceremonies for tonight, America's foremost dramatic actor, that great and distinguished thespian whose supreme art has at last won for him the crown of Dean of the American Theater, Mr. Harry Lillis Crosby.
That will be all, Carpenter. You may leave me now.
Oh, no, no. But, Mr. Crosby.
I have spoken, Carpenter. Leave me.
Oh, no, but, sir,
Did you not hear me, Carpenter? A blow. Cup of sneak.
Mr. Crosby, I only wanted to congratulate you on winning the Academy Award for the finest dramatic performance of the year.
Oh, that. There's nothing, really.
Yes, I know, but, In your honor, sir, next week at the Music Hall, we're going to present you with not one, but three Oscars.
Really?
Yeah.
Three of those little statues?
Yes, sir. One in Swiss, one in Roquefort, and one in Limburger.
Well, that's a very touching sentiment. I shall treasure them until the neighbors object. Oh, Gad, sometimes I wonder whether I'll be able to stand immortality. The life of a genius is a dreary one. There are so few of us. This heart of mine was doing very well. The world was fine, as far as I could tell. And then quite suddenly I met you. Then I dreamed of gay amours. At dawn I woke up singing sentimental overtures. This heart of mine is gaily dancing now. I taste the wine of real romancing now. Somehow this crazy world has taken on a wonderful design. As long as life endures, it's yours, this heart of mine.
Thank you, Major.
Ready to smile again with radio's home folks, Vacansade, written by Paul Wright. Vacansade is brought to you by Procter & Gamble's Crisco, the pure all-vegetable shortening. It's digestible. And now, here's Zella Lay. Hey, Zella, what are you smacking your lips about? Something good to eat, I bet you.
Reading my mind, huh? Well, you're not wrong, but you'll never in the wide world guess what it is. Really, friends, it's a dandy recipe, one the Crisco people sent along. Not to know how long you have a package of noodles in your pantry. And like me, you probably look at them a dozen times and wish you knew something a little different to do with them. Well, see if this doesn't strike your fancy. It's a Crisco recipe for cheese-flavored fried noodles. You boil and drain the noodles, then with Crisco piping hot in your skillet, you put them in to fry. Let them get good and brown and crispy. Can't you almost smell them? And when the noodles are really crusty, you drain, salt, and sprinkle them with finely grated sharp cheese. Say, that'll make a hit with your family. You just try it, and you better plan to make plenty. You know the appetites youngsters bring home. Golly, aren't you thankful you don't have to worry about Crisco fried foods being hard to digest? There's no reason to worry with Crisco in your skillet. In fact, Crisco fried foods are so digestible, I even let the youngsters pitch right in. You see, Crisco's pure and all vegetable, a digestible shortening. 9 out of 10 doctors say that. Really, it's the finest quality shortening for everything. You'll see, with Crisco, everything you cook tastes better, and it's digestible. And friends, on your ration stamps, don't forget to use up brown stamps Y and Z. They're good through March 20th. And now, back to Vic and Sage.
Well, sir, Mr. Victor Gook has just arrived home from his day's work at the office as we join him at the small house halfway up on the next block now. He's standing beside the library table in the living room, removing his hat and overcoat, and speaking cheerily to Sade, who's darning socks on the davenport. Listen.
Do I look like a pretty girl 17 years old?
No.
Do I look like a pretty girl 26 years old? Refuse to give a poor fellow any compliments, huh?
What are you feeling so good about?
Wouldn't you feel good if you were wealthy, talented, popular, and good-looking?
Yes, I sure would. You didn't get a raise in your pay, did you?
Well, what an absurd fancy. Here, take my coat and hat in the hallway and hang them up.
Uh-huh.
Well, I'll drape them over this chair for a moment. Darling little Russell can take him in the hallway.
I have no idea where darling little Russell is.
Out in the backyard.
Oh.
Exchanging insults with Heine Call.
Yeah, I guess I did hear kids yelling a minute ago.
Gee, I wish you'd tell me I resemble a pretty girl 26 years old.
Oh, yes.
Pretty girl 28 years old?
Oh, goodness. Tell me what it is you got up your sleeve. You will sooner or later. Silliness is funny and all right, but why so long?
You won't permit a fella to have any fun.
No, I guess not. Oh, this must be Russell. Hi, dear.
Hi.
In the kitchen, are they?
Hello, Bob.
Hello, Govitas. Ain't that sweet? He gets more grown up every day. Says hello, Gov, just as clear.
Has this dandy news you're hugging to yourself got anything to do with your eating supper downtown this evening?
Sadie. Incorrigible.
Grocery store for you, pretty quick, Mr. Mann.
Okay.
We're having supper by ourselves tonight, you and me.
Eating downtown, are you, Gov?
How dare you ask me a question like that? You're impertinent, sir. Take my hat and overcoat in the hallway and hang them up.
Anymore, it's getting to where nobody would even consider hanging up their own hat and overcoat.
Isn't he a wicked boy to talk to his parents that way?
Yeah.
I read in the newspaper about a case in Indiana where a boy...
I think we've had enough from you, Russell.
Okay.
I don't like to crush his baby heart and make him feel so bad that he'll sob and cry. But at the same time, I feel I should be more strict and insist on opinions.
Oh, Vic, you rattle on and on about nothing. What is it you got up your sleeve? When you telephoned this afternoon, you said you wouldn't be eating at home tonight. I suppose Mr. Buller was in town.
Mr. Buller is not in town. Mr. Buller is not in town.
And had invited you to supper at the little tiny petite pheasant feather tea shopping.
No.
Oh, just like that brother-in-law, Miss Froucher's there on Mulberry Street she complains about. He's got to be funny man's all the time. Not just part of the time, but all the time. Putting lighted matches in the soles of people's shoes, coming up behind you and screaming. Telling jokes, singing comical songs. Miss Froucher says an evening of it's enough to drive a person stark raving mad. And her and Mr. Froucher eat Sunday dinner there every other Sunday.
Surely my humor is more subtle, rarefied, and piquant than that.
Not much, no.
Hello, Rethel.
Hello, Gus.
You hung my hat and overcoat neatly in the hallway?
Yeah.
Good work. You may step to the pantry and help yourself to a level teaspoonful of powdered sugar.
Oh, come on. I'll get down to business. Where are you having supper this evening?
That is a fair question and deserves an honest answer. I am dining at the Butler House Hotel.
Oh?
I am Fancy Vic Gook, the fashionable fop from Freeport, Florida.
Are them important kitchenware fellas from Plant 26 or whatever it is back in town and you're supposed to entertain them?
Nope.
Oh, now don't start that laughing silliness.
I can't help it, Dr. Sleep.
Oh, my.
Bluetooth Johnson sometimes gets to
that. Grocery store for you, Mr. Blister. were eaten by ourselves, what would taste good?
I always enjoy macaroni and cheese.
Sure, though, here's the story. I laughed and acted asinine because this really amounts to a little joke on you.
Joke on me? Joke on me?
Yes.
Well, let's hear the joke that's on me.
Bluetooth Johnson gets a great
quiet, Russell. Trot out the joke that's on me.
Well, kiddo, I'm not the kind that makes the other fella eat crow, and I'm not the kind that rubs a thing in. But could you guess who's my host at the Butterhouse Hotel at supper this evening?
No, who?
Hank Ketchup.
He's buying you a meal?
He's more than buying me a meal. He's my host.
And this is a joke on me?
In a way, yes.
I know a good joke on you, Russell.
What's that?
The Mississippi River goes past Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Yeah, that's a dandy joke on me.
No, kiddo, listen. Hank Gutstop got the job of house detective in at the hotel there. About 2 weeks ago,
I'm familiar with all that. He was here one evening wearing his duck hunter's cap and checkered vest.
No, but listen.
Well, where does the joke on me come in?
Well, listen and I'll tell you.
All right.
For many years, you've held up Hank as an object of derision.
Well, that's what he was.
You thought of him as a thing of shreds and patches. You pictured him as a no-good loafer asleep on railroad station platforms.
Sure, that's right. Mm-hmm.
A pool room tout, a barbershop lounger, a creature crude, coarse, and contemptible.
Exactly, sure. Mm-hmm.
In the light of all that, how do you feel about Hank being host to five of his friends at a private, stylish supper at one of the finest hotels in central Illinois?
Well, I suppose if he's flush with money, he's got as much right as anybody else to buy a meal.
Wait a minute. Kiddo, does it seem in character for a no-good bum to put on a luxurious, smart, and sophisticated banquet for five of
his... peach butter and talky-talk. Anybody with the spine bullocks can walk in the purple room there and order a luxurious, smart, and sophisticated...
Did I say purple room?
He isn't putting on his luxurious, smart, and sophisticated banquet at the dinky little coffee shop off the lobby there where you eat off the arm of the chair and...
Sadie, what an odd notion.
Well, is he?
No. Kiddo, Hank Gutstop is entertaining five of his friends in his own apartment.
At the Bright Kentucky Hotel?
No, Russell. Not at the Bright Kentucky Hotel.
That's where he lives?
No, Russell.
Has he moved?
Yes, Russell.
Where to?
The Butler House Hotel.
Really?
The Butler House Hotel. Hank Gutstop has apartments at the Butler House Hotel. And get this, friend. The Brighter Suite, no less.
The Brighter Suite.
Well, for mercy's sake.
For mercy's sake is right.
The bridal suite.
Here's the details of it, Sage.
Yeah, let's have the details of it.
As detective at the Butler House, the management felt that Hank should reside there. You see, he's supposed to be on call at all hours of the day or night. So at the management's expense, Hank's effects were transferred from the Bright Kentucky to the Butler House. Isn't that going up in the world?
How did he rate the bridal suite?
The management quartered him there because it's so large and expensive it's too infrequently patronized. They have to have too much money, see? Most young married couples that stop at the Butler House don't feel like they can afford the price. So instead of letting it go to waste, the management has installed Hank.
Does he have to pay any rent?
Not a penny.
Good.
I had a little notion you'd be mildly surprised, Sade.
Uh-huh.
You'll eat your supper in the bridal suite this evening, huh, Gov?
I'll eat my supper in the bridal suite this evening.
Waiters, I expect, will bring it up.
The head waiter will look in first.
He'll have a full affair menu.
Exactly. And he'll take our order.
And then a whole bunch of waiters will wheel in little go-carts piled with rich food and silver platters.
Who
beside you is attending the banquet?
A group of Hank's old comrades from the Bright Kentucky.
Huh?
Hank is not proud. Brilliant success hasn't turned Hank's head. The dear old chums he knew in lean times are welcome in his richly appointed bower.
Stacy Yop, I suppose, and B.B. Ball.
Stacy Yop, B.B. Ball, Y.I.I.Y. Skeever, Fishigan from Sishigan, Michigan, and even the old battered janitor and man of all work there at the Bright Kentucky.
Pelter Unbree.
Yes, Pelter Unbree. He, too, will be there. Poor soul.
Oh.
So there, Sade, you have the story of Hank Gutstop's meteoric rise in the world.
Oh.
From a thing of shreds and patches, from a no-good loafer sleeping on railroad station platforms, from a pool room tout, a barbershop lounger, and a creature crude, coarse, and contemptible, Hank Gutstop has become the occupant of the bridal suite of the Butler House. has become a host at gay, smart, sophisticated private banquets for his friends. Is a living, breathing part of the elegance and splendor and glamorous flashing fire of one of the finest and most brilliant hotels in central Illinois.
Hey, hey.
Yes. Hey, hey.
What do you say, Russell?
I say hey, hey, too.
Which concludes another brief interlude at the small house halfway up in the next block. Friends, may I present a member of the Women's Army Corps, better known as a WAC.
Hello, everybody.
Well, now, let's see. You're a sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, friends, somehow, I think this is one sergeant I wouldn't mind taking orders from.
It must be the uniform.
Well, it's certainly a snappy one. There's no doubt about that. But tell me, Sergeant, how do you like being a WAC?
It's wonderful. I've had lots of fun, and I've been to more places than I ever thought I'd see. I'm kind of hoping I may take another trip soon.
Uh-huh, overseas?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, that ought to be really exciting. Well, now, about the work you do. Do you like that?
Love it. You know, now you can choose the type of job you want to do when you join the WAC.
Uh-huh, and there are lots of jobs to pick from.
And every one of them is important.
You bet everyone is, Sergeant. Believe me, friends, the Army needs WACs. If you're anywhere from 20 to 49 years old, the biggest thing that you can do for your country is join the WAC. Drop in at your nearest Army recruiting station today, won't you? And join the WAC. And don't forget to listen to Vic and Say the next time. This is Ed Roberts saying good day for Crisco. It's digestible.
Presented in the public interest, the program that brings you for the first time on the air a nationwide manhunt in action. The actual facts to date on a man wanted. From the record, hear the on-the-spot reports of the actual people involved. Real names are used. Nothing is withheld. No one is protected. Here are the dramatic eyewitness accounts of a man wanted. Wanted for jailbreak. And now, Wanted's on-the-spot investigator, Walter McGraw.
Good evening. Once again, I'm going to take you around the country on a manhunt for a criminal who is now at large. I'm going to bring you the actual witnesses to this man's crimes. They are going to give you their stories. Remember, these people are the actual witnesses, not actors. And every one of them is putting himself on the spot to give you first-hand information about a man who is wanted. In 1950, you and I look back at the early 30s with a certain amount of horror. Remember the headline?
John Dillinger escaped from Crown Point with a wooden gun. Peggy McMath kidnapped. $80,000 ransom paid kidnappers. Lincoln, Nebraska National Bank and Trust Company robbed of $2
million. $2 million. Harvey Bailey masterminded that one. Tonight, we turn the crime spotlight on an early day member of the Harvey Bailey mob. He's now back in operation, and he's wanted. Listen, these are the facts.
The date, April 14th, 1932. The place, the Wilcox Gas and Oil Company, Tulsa, Oklahoma. The time, late at night.
The voices you hear next are the actual voices of the people who, through no fault of their own, are involved in the case of the Dope Fiend of the West. The first voice you hear is that of a porter employed by the Wilcox Gas and Oil Company.
I'm Dave Evans, porter for the Wilcox Oil Company. I was feeling kind of tired, so I decided to take a nap on Mr. Wilcox's couch. I was just about getting to sleep when I heard somebody at the transom. I thought it was Mr. Harley. So I said, Mr. Harley? He said, yes, this is me. Open the door and let me in. When I did, two men came into the room and stuck a gun in my ribs and tied me up. I could hear them in the next room hammering and bammering on the safe with sledgehammers. I don't know what time they left. The next morning, my boss man, Harley Raines, came in and untied me.
I'm Harvey Raines, building manager for the Wilcox Oil and Gas Company, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Upon coming to work, I found that the building had been robbed. My boy, Dave Evans, the porter, he told me that the boys went through the building and robbed it. They robbed five safes out of six, knocking the combinations from the safe with the sledgehammer
and chiseled. They got about $1,000 in cash and $6,000 in bonds and securities. Later, Mr. M.P. Appleby, vice president and treasurer of our company at that time, discovered that he had lost a very valuable diamond, which he had concealed under his desk with a wad of chewing gum. After this examination, we called the police.
Tulsa police responded to the call at once. Their first impression of the robbery was collusion, an inside job. Usually, safecrackers don't look for diamonds in a wad of chewing gum. Naturally, every employer and employee was cross-examined.
I tell you, finding that diamond was strictly an accident.
Happy accident. Now Tulsa police started a routine check. The robbers had taken not only cash, but bonds and securities. Bonds and securities are hard to handle, too hard for the average crook. Police knew this job was done by men who were certain they could trade those securities for ready cash. So police started Operation Rogues Gallery.
Every safecracker or armed robber who had any connection with any big mob was called in for questioning.
Thousands questioned in order to develop information. The stool pigeon level came through.
The guys you want are with the Bailey outfit. They're Harry Campbell and Glenn Roy Wright.
This is A.M. Smith of the Tulsa Police Department. I, with Earl Gardner and Leo Granger, observed Harry Campbell and Glenn Roy Wright in an automobile at 11th and Lewis Avenue and placed them under arrest and at the time found that they were heavily armed. They were taken to the police station where they were charged with the robbery of the Wilcox Oil Company.
Now police had their men, but the men had the money, the bonds, and the securities from the Wilcox job. And they had connections.
Sure, as members of the Bailey mob, they just call up Harvey Bailey and tell him they want a good lawyer. They get the famous J. Earl Smith to represent them. And the nice part is, Campbell and Wright don't have to pay a cent for his services. They just turn over the Wilcox bond.
Smith is a mighty smart lawyer. He tells the boys to go ahead and plead guilty and gets them a lesser plea than armed robbery. Plain, simple burglary. Next thing we hear, Harry Campbell and Glenn Roy Wright are out of jail on a measly $1,500 bail bond.
Harry Campbell and Glenn Roy Wright jump bail. They're wanted by this department.
For 1 year, no word at all was heard of the fugitives. Meanwhile, big shot gang leader Harvey Bailey hit the headlines. He was accused of robbing two banks of better than $2 million, and he was in jail in Fort Scott, Kansas. According to our reconstruction from the Tulsa police files...
Well, Bailey buys himself a whole rig of smart lawyers. Then on the side, he calls in his old pal, lawyer J. Earl Smith, and the story is, and maybe it's only a story, that Bailey has an idea which wasn't so legal.
They say Bailey ordered Smith to buy off a Fort Scott judge and jury to make sure he wouldn't go to jail. Well, according to the boys, Smith says he needs a lot of money to pull a trick like that. And we hear Bailey hands over a fortune to Smith in bonds.
On August 16, 1932, the case of the people against Harvey Bailey closed. Verdict, Bailey was guilty. He was sentenced to life in the federal pen.
As for lawyer Smith and the fistful of bonds...
Well, Smith went back to Tulsa.
I'm George Cochran. One night, Orrin Jackson and me passed this car on a new by road. As we passed, I looked back and I noticed there was a man lying there. And I thought he was either drunk or hurt or something, so I kept on talking to Orrin Jackson. After we got about a half a mile, he said, "Do you want to go back and see about it?" And I says, "Yeah," and let's turn around and go back and see. And so we drove back, and I got out of the car. Went around, and I seen this man was very dead. He'd been shot. The bullet had knocked his teeth out. And something very strange. There were a nickel and a penny on the ground by the body.
That dead man was lawyer J. Earl Smith. Now, Tulsa police went to work investigating the mysterious death of Lawyer Smith. Leads? The nickel and the penny found beside the body labeled it a gang job. An Oklahoma custom that spells double cross. The second lead came from the wife of the murdered man.
Well, she told me that her husband was home relaxing when he received a telephone call, and she just happened to listen in on the extension. Her husband hung up and rushed out of the house. He said he'd be back in 20 minutes, but he never came back. Ms. Smith insists she recognized the voice of the man on the telephone. She says it was Harry Campbell.
Once again, the underworld was dredged for information on the missing pair, and new information came in.
Harry Campbell and Glenroy Wright have been around here for the past 3 months. They've been palling with a guy named Karpis. Creepy Karpis. Seems Campbell and Glenroy and this Karpis owed Bailey a favor. What better way to pay back a favor than get rid of this Smith?
Rumors, underworld talk, but no proof. And Harry Campbell and Glenroy Wright were still unavailable to the police. But they were hot and wanted. Then on October 18th, 1933, 81 miles from Tulsa, the Sales Day Association was holding a cattle and hog auction in a small town called Stillwater.
I'm George Fleshner. I was the auctioneer at the Stillwater sale. We had a large sale that day. Sold approximately 723 hogs, approximately 387 head of cattle, which amounted to total of $11,000 and some odd dollars. After the sale at night, there were approximately 15 people left in the building. Some of them were still settling up when a man showed up in the office door facing me. He was standing with his coat collar up and gun pointed to the floor. He said, "Get him up, this is a stick-up." And I, like all the rest of them at first, thought he was joking. I thought he was either drunk or maybe a dope hit or pulling some joke. When he said, "What do you so-and-so think this is, Joe?" I said, "Get him up." Of course, we immediately all got them up. One of the fellas stuck his gun in Harley Thomas's back, and Harley was standing right there with his son.
Harley Thomas's son was only 11 years old at that time.
My name is Bill Thomas. My father, Harley Thomas, and I run the Ford dealership here in Stillwater. As I remember, when they stuck the gun in Dad's ribs, I was sitting there with my foot across the door, and I told this dirty-looking fella he couldn't come in. He turned and shoved what I thought was a machine gun in my ribs, told me to shut up and get my hands up. And he didn't have to tell me that because I'd already gotten my hands up. I was scared to death. A few minutes later, after we'd been marched out into the main auditorium of the building, while searching us, I became a little bit worried about the 10-cent piece I had in the upper pocket of the bib of my overalls, but they didn't get it. A little later, I was standing in a position where I could see into the office. I saw this one fellow spill, several nickels, dimes, and quarters, and that like on the floor while pouring this money into a sack that looked like a mail sack. And I was rather surprised he got down and picked up each one of the coins, and I thought he might have left a few, as much as he got. A little later, he came back in the main auditorium, and he and this other fellow who was standing over in the corner waving a machine gun on us kept threatening us and calling us the most vile, vicious names I've ever heard. Just filth. I've never heard such filthy things said to anyone in all my life. After threatening to burn us down, they finally departed, and I'll never forget how tired my arms were. Felt awful good to get those arms back down.
Once again, state police turned to Operation Rogues Gallery in hopes that one eyewitness would recognize a face. And they struck pay dirt.
That fella there. Saw him this morning at the auction. Talked to him for a piece, and he said he was here to buy a hog. But I noticed he didn't buy none.
I don't think he gave me his name.
His name was Glenn Roy Wright, wanted now on three charges. The Wilcox job, the murder of J. Earl Smith, and the Stillwater robbery. Now police began to figure likely hideouts in the district, and they looked to the Cookson Hills, Indian country, a mountain wilderness known as a refuge for gangdom. A posse of over 300 men on horseback was organized to comb that area.
I'm Pitano, brave of the Kiowa tribe. Many moons ago, during powwow time, when the young braves and the young squaws of my people were dancing, singing like they are now, a white man's posse came up into my hills. Man with star, take out picture of thin, white-faced man. Ask me if I see him. I say no. I just do my farming.
Result of posse, no pale-faced gangsters, no Glenn Roy Wright, no Harry Campbell. But early in March, a peculiar set of circumstances focused the attention of the entire state of Oklahoma on an isolated farmhouse called the Brooks Place. The Brooks Place had been rented by a mysterious Mr. and Mrs. Brackett, who decidedly did not look like farmers.
This is C.L. Welch, Deputy Sheriff of Creek County, and on this Glenn Roy Wright deal, the first thing I put him to studying was this old man Brackett had this place rented. He went to buying all these groceries himself. He done all the buying personally himself. First they were happy about it because he was a good cash customer, and then they got suspicious on account of they bought so many groceries, and that's when they notified the deputy sheriff of Drumright, Oklahoma.
The overbuying of groceries could have been innocent enough, but the local citizens coupled this with the fact that dozens of strange cars drove in and out of the Brooks place all day and night. And then there were other reports.
This is Charles Webster, County Attorney, Creek County, Oklahoma. The neighbors reported that there was numerous shootings of farms on the Brooks farm, and they thought it was a machine gun, and that they were very suspicious of a machine gun being fired at that place. And they brought some of the bullets which they had obtained on the Brooks farm, and they were examined and they were found to be machine gun bullets. The sheriff's office at Drumright notified the police department of Tulsa, Oklahoma.
This is Captain N.C. Williams, Tulsa Police Department, Detective Bureau. This report from Drumright, Oklahoma, together with the information we had compiled, led us to believe that Mr. and Ms. Brackett were running a hideout for gangsters. On March the 15th, 1934, a posse of 28 to 30 officers from all over the county prepared to swoop down on the farmhouse shortly before dawn.
I'm Lloyd Miller of the Tulsa Police Department. I was one of the men that was on the raid. When we arrived, Mrs. Brackett was coming out of the kitchen. She looked up and saw the officers approaching the house, and she screamed. We made a run for her and used her as a shield, going through the kitchen door and into the living room, where we found four men all in bed, including Glenn Leroy Wright. Glenn Leroy had a sawed-off shotgun under his pillow, and I stepped on the automatic shotgun and told Leroy not to move. After they were arrested, we then searched the premises.
In the search of the farmhouse, police found 15 safes, an arsenal of weapons, a year's supply of canned goods, and a quantity of nitroglycerin. The four sleeping beauties were then turned over to the sheriff at Drumright. Now, police learned for the first time that Glenn Roy had a new accomplice, a hot hoodlum named Pat Collins. And once again, Glenn Roy proved he had connections. A secret meeting was called by the biggest names in gangdom. Creepy Carpus, the Parker Boys, Pretty Boy Floyd, Adam Ricchetti, and old pal Harry Campbell. They hired a lawyer to represent Wright and accomplice Collins. They had ideas on how to spring these men. Not legal ideas. They were working on a jailbreak, and they demanded that the lawyer take part in it.
Tillman L. Wilcox, Under Sheriff of Payne County.
Immediately upon the return of this prominent lawyer to the city of Stillwater, he called the sheriff of this county, M.J. Bradley, and myself to his home about 2 o'clock in the morning. At that time, he gave us a brief resume as to what happened in this meeting, even though he made the statement at that time might mean his life. He said they were contemplating springing Benroy Wright and Pat Collins, which was staged to take place on Sunday night following this meeting. The day before this stage spring was to take place, which is on Saturday, Glenroy's mother and brother visited him. We were well aware of the fact that they evidently had alerted them to the possible break. But on Sunday night, adequate guards was placed on top of the courthouse with machine guns. Immediately in the courthouse, I was placed at the head of the stairs of the Thompson sub, also equipped with a steel vest, 400 rounds of ammunition. The jailer was placed in a cell next to Glenroy Wright and Pat Collins and given a gun, also a gas bomb, and he had specific instruction as a last resort to not let either prisoner get out, to kill them both. Approximately a few minutes till 10 o'clock, there was 2 cars loaded with men, all strangers, made approximately 2 rounds around the courthouse square, evidently making observations. At approximately 10 p.m., the lights suddenly went out in the courthouse. We immediately called the custodian of the courthouse. He, upon an investigation, found the main switch that was thrown in the ladies' restroom. How it was thrown, nobody knew. However, the break did not occur, and the continuous watch was kept until both parties were transferred to penitentiary.
The jailbreak thwarted, Glenroy Wright was held without bail. First, police questioned him in the matter of the murder of Lawyer Smith.
He said he knew nothing, and nothing could make him talk.
The state had no proof, and to this day, the murder of Smith remains unsolved. So the state concentrated on the Wilcox Oil and Stillwater auction jobs. On May 17, 1934, without benefit of the brilliant but now defunct Lawyer Smith, Glenroy Wright was sentenced to life imprisonment. Now, Walter McGraw.
This was the end of an era. The notorious Harvey Bailey is still locked up. Harry Campbell was finally caught in 1936. He's in Leavenworth. Pat Collins died in the pen. But as for Glenroy Wright, well, he was in the state pen at McAllister.
This is Warden Burford of the Oklahoma State Penitentiary at McAllister. I received a telephone call from the doctor that was waiting on Glenroy Wright's mother. He informed me that she was at the point of death and couldn't possibly live but a few more days. And while she was alive, she'd like to see her son one more time. I called the boy in and asked him if he wanted to go, and of course he did. So I sent guard A.L. Jones to escort him up to see his mother that one more time.
My name is A.L. Jones. I'm a dog sergeant at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary, McAllister, Oklahoma. Last summer, a year ago, I was assigned to take Glenroy Wright, a prisoner of this institution, to the bedside of his dying mother at Tulsa, Oklahoma. We traveled by the way of automobile. He was very agreeable on the way up. When we arrived at his house, his folks seemed very agreeable. We arrived at home in Tulsa about 8 that morning. His mother was unconscious, unable to recognize her son until about 3 p.m. that afternoon. He went in the room to see his mother, and that's the last I ever saw of him.
After serving 14 years, Wright had escaped. As for Mother Wright, she had a miraculous recovery. Tulsa police instituted immediate proceedings to effect Wright's recapture. Again, a full year passed with no information. Then, on the stool pigeon level, word filtered through.
Glenroy is traveling with the Dallas gang. I know that whole bunch uses a needle. Heroin. What a bunch. They don't think nothing of human life.
Oklahoma wired Dallas, Texas for information. But according to Dallas,
nothing on your Glenroy here, but we'll have plenty on others. They're bad actors.
That investigation fizzled out. And once again, all was silent on the Glen Roy right front until...
Dateline, January 8, 1949, Detroit, Michigan. The Danchoff Fur Store was robbed by two men. From witnesses, an excellent description of the robbers was obtained.
Description, first man.
White, 35, dark ruddy complexion, war gloves.
Description, second man.
White, age 50, white hair, sallow complexion, drawn thin face, habit of coughing over his shoulder, war gloves.
Tulsa authorities would have recognized the second man, but he was a stranger to Detroit. The police were hard at work sifting the files, looking for a picture that fitted these men, when the case broke wide open.
Police received a call that the Schwartz Brothers Jewelry Company was being robbed.
Detroit police responded to the call and broke up the robbery, taking three men into custody.
Taken into custody, these three men were quickly identified as part of the Dallas gang.
Detective Harry Martin, attached Detroit Police Department, Detective Division Narcotic Bureau. Hypodermic syringe and needle was turned over to me by an officer who had arrested three men and attempted a jewelry store holdup. It was found that this needle and syringe contained an opium derivative. A U.S. narcotic agent and myself began searching the car, taking off the hubcaps, lifting the seats, lifting the cover on the battery, and a very thorough search was made, but no further narcotics were found. We then proceeded to talk to these three men, as we knew them to be part of the Dallas mob, which is operating throughout the United States, holding up and breaking into various drug houses. And during the course of the interview, the thought that impressed me most were that life was very cheap. They had served so much time in these Southwest prisons that they were strictly hardened to the extent that they would tell you nothing or try to help themselves.
Finally, however, under questioning, they confessed to the Danchoff fur robbery and named their accomplice. They identified the white-haired dope addict. Now, Glen Roy Wright, the product of America's gang era, was again wanted. It is not our function here to determine the guilt or innocence of a man, nor do we intend to. But based on the facts you've heard tonight and or other pertinent material, Glen Roy Wright is wanted.
For jailbreak. For armed robbery. And by the federal government on a narcotics charge. Here again is Walter McGraw.
You can help find Glen Roy Wright, but to do so, you must be informed of all the facts. What does he look like? How does he dress? What are his habits? These we will give you, so stand by. How can you recognize him? Listen, and listen carefully.
This is Bob Travis, Chief Identification Officer with the Department of Public Safety, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Here's an official description of Glen Roy Wright. Age 51, height 5 feet 8 and 1 half inch, weight 130, build slender, hair gray, scars and marks, gunshot wound on outer left forearm, 5 inches above wrist.
Now back to Walter McGraw in New York.
If you should see Glen Roy Wright, don't go up to him. One of our listeners thought she recognized Edward Sadowski, who was wanted for murder. This woman went up to Sadowski with a picture of him and asked if he was really the wanted man. She could have been killed. If you see a wanted man, remember, just call your own local police. Give them the fullest possible information, but don't put yourself in danger. Now, to help you, we have one more voice to add to the sum total you've heard tonight. The voice of the underworld.
Let me give you some information on Glen Roy Wright. He's part of the Dallas mob. And word has it that the head of the Dallas mob is a bondsman. Get it? Some racket. He bails the boys out of the can when they get into trouble. And in return, he gets part of the take. Glen Roy Wright is a hophead. This guy has got to hang around the big cities. And everybody knows when a guy is a hophead, he's dangerous. And with a gun in this guy's hand, he'll blow his top.
If you have no other way of seeing a picture of Glen Roy Wright, go to your local post office. A poster with his picture is on the wall. Study that face.
Glen Roy Wright is 52 years old.
His hair is white. He's thin and gaunt-looking. He is thought to have tuberculosis. He has a nervous habit of coughing over his shoulder. He is a sick man physically and mentally, vicious beyond measure. He has no regard for human life. He enjoys wearing custom-made suits.
Tonight you've heard the facts on a man who's been caged up for 20 years. His use of heroin has totally destroyed both his health and his mind. We're not on a manhunt tonight. We're hunting a wild animal. Glenn Roy Wright must be taken out of circulation. And you can help. Look at what you've done so far. Look at your wanted scoreboard. Our first case was Willie the Actor Sutton. Authorities tell us Sutton's been spotted. Case number two, fugitive Mike Selleck, was reported by two wanted listeners in Los Angeles. But despite good police work, he too faded into the woodwork. Our third case, the case of Sadowski, is now closed. He was caught as a result of our nationwide manhunt. As for last week's case, Tenuto, at this moment we are awaiting word on him. But the best bet seems to be New York. Remember, you the listeners, can find these men and help pull them in. Now, this is Walter McGraw saying, there's no time like now to wipe out crime.
Be with us next week when you will hear the actual people involved give their eyewitness account of the well-liked killer who is wanted. Wanted for jailbreak. All material heard on tonight's program was factual, from the record. The voice of the late Dave Evans was impersonated. Real names were used. No one was protected. Tonight's report was written by P.L. Mayer. Music by Morris Mamorski. The narrator was Fred Collins. Wanted was supervised for NBC by James Kovac and was produced and directed by Walter McGraw. Bill Stern returns to Sports Newsreel next on NBC.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.